Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world.
Our trivia question for this week is, how did the economic situation in Israel in the 1950s cause Kurdish Jews there to modify the recipe of one of their traditional foods? Joel Haber was born in the United States and has lived in Jerusalem since 2009. He's an expert on Jewish food history, with an emphasis on the relationship between food and culture. In Israel, Joel is a licensed tour guide and a food culture journalist. His most popular tour is a culinary tasting and history tour in Jerusalem's famous outdoor market, Shuk Machane Yehuda. His writing appears on his blog and his new website, and he has published articles in the Nasher, Tablet, and Tradition, among others. He has lectured extensively in online and in-person venues in multiple countries.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Joel. Could you first tell us a little bit about your own background, where you're from, and a little about your family and what you studied and what you did in the States?
Sure. So I grew up in the United States. I grew up in New Jersey, lived in New York for many years in Manhattan, and lived in LA for about 5 years before I moved to Israel, which was in March of 2009. Grew up in a what would be called, I guess, a modern Orthodox family, although I don't really like labels very much, and didn't study anything connected with food, actually. I studied English. And later on, I got a master's in media studies and studied film. And I worked in the film industry for quite a while I was in the States, pretty much most of my adult life until moving to Israel, and then completely changed everything once I got here.
What caused you to move to Israel? And what are you doing there?
Well, it's awesome here. So that's the main thing. No, I mean, obviously, as a Jew, I feel at home here. But even if I didn't, I prefer the lifestyle here and the values here. And those are things that I really appreciate and that would make me want to live here. Professionally, I do two different things here. When I made Aliyah, when I moved to Israel, I didn't know yet what I would be doing for a living. I didn't move for work. I moved for life. And once I got here, I figured it out. And early on, I realized that I wanted to become a tour guide. So I'm a licensed tour guide in Israel. It's a profession that you need to be licensed for here. And I guide all over, but I tend to do a lot in Jerusalem. And specifically, I have a very popular culinary tour in Machane Yehuda Market, Jerusalem's famous open-air market. And from that, as I began to dig down into the food that I would be guiding and explaining, it also opened up for me the whole world of food history. And so in addition to the tour guiding, I also research and write and lecture about Jewish food history.
Okay, so I have a question for you.
Please.
I have a lot of questions for you. How would you define Jewish food? In other words, if a food is kosher, does that make it Jewish? And on the other hand, does a food have to be kosher to be Jewish?
Good. So the first part of the question, I could say that, what makes a food Jewish? I think there's almost as many answers to that question as there are people who ask it. I would very strongly argue against those people who say there is no such thing as Jewish food. I think that they are putting requirements on our cuisine that they don't put on others, namely that they want it to be something that is uniquely ours, indigenous to us, all of these things. By the way, there are foods that are uniquely ours and indigenous to us also, which means those are certainly Jewish foods. But I think that if you want to talk on a broader level, I would say that there's sort of three categories of what makes something Jewish food. One of which is those foods that are uniquely ours. The best example of that, of course, would be matzah, and thus all of the things that are derived from matzah. The second category, which I think in many ways is the most interesting, are foods that maybe we eat them and other people eat them, but our version is different, often because of kashrut or other things of that nature.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. So for example, Jews in Italy would make prosciutto out of goose instead of out of pork. That's an example. It's a classic example. There's many others. And the last, and this is, I think, the broadest one, which really gives us a little bit of leeway, are the foods that people associate with us. You know, if other people say that they're our foods, who are we to say they're not? And what I mean by that is not just things like bagels, but I mean things that if you go around the world, there are foods from many different countries that in their languages are called Jewish X. For example, there's, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce it, so if there's any Dutch people out there, please forgive me, but there's some sort of a Dutch cake or cookie called something like Jutis butter cake or something like that, which means like Jewish butter cookie. And like, if they're calling it Jewish, I would say that it probably is, right?
So that's a very interesting question, because it might be, it might not be.
Well, I mean, it's being identified as Jewish, and I think that says something. There's a reason that, and often we can figure out why it's called that. But, and it's not just, that's not the one example. There's many, many. I've been gathering as I research, I start to make a list of all of these foods from around the world that are identified as Jewish foods. But to your second half of your question about, does it need to be Jewish, kosher? And if it's kosher, does that mean that it's Jewish? So I think that that's a question that is debated. For example, let's start with, yes, the vast majority of foods that are Jewish foods are in fact kosher. However,
or could be kosher. I mean, for example, roast chicken, the chicken might be kosher and might not be kosher, but it might be a Jew, what we consider to be a Jewish dish or chicken soup.
Correct, correct. When I say that, what I mean is that inherently there's nothing unkosher about them, but you're correct. Of course, if it is made with an animal that was unslaughtered, then it wouldn't be kosher. I don't mean that. I mean when we're describing the dish as a dish. But interestingly, I think that there are examples, and not many, but there are examples of foods that we could say, or at least you could make a good argument that they are definitely Jewish foods that are actually unkosher. So the best example that I can think of, I come from America, I believe you do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're talking about Jewish deli in America, as you know, many delis these days, most delis these days that are Jewish style delis are not kosher.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just mean that they might have milk and they might have meat there, but there's actually sandwiches. For example, the most famous would be the Reuben sandwich, which was 100% invented by Jews for a Jewish style deli. And it is absolutely unkosher because it mixes milk and meat.
I think you should explain to our listeners what a Reuben sandwich
sure.
is.
So there are many laws of kosher, of what makes a food kosher or not. But one of the classic ones, which is an extension of the biblical prohibition against cooking a calf in the milk of its mother, or cooking a kid, a goat, in the milk of its mother, the rabbis extended that to not mixing any milk and meat together, with a tremendous number of extensions. So traditionally, when you go around the world, traditional kosher food and traditional Jewish food, therefore, does not mix milk and meat. However, this dish, this sandwich, has, if I remember correctly, it's corned beef, but it's definitely a meat, and mm-hmm. it has Swiss cheese. And that would not be in any way kosher according to traditional Jewish law. And yet, I think it's very difficult to argue that it's not a Jewish food. So that's an example of something that, arguably, no, not every Jewish food must be kosher, but I would say that the vast majority are.
Okay, now let's talk about Israeli food. I have an Israeli friend who happens to be Sephardic and who says that in Israel, they call Ashkenazi food washed chicken.
Okay.
Is Israeli food necessarily Jewish? Because there must be Israeli food from the other cultures, the non-Jewish cultures that live in Israel.
Correct. So you've put together two things. I'll start with the first part about the Ashkenazic food. So one of my sort of missions, I would say, when I deal with Jewish food is like kind of like two sides of a coin. On the one hand, I try to broaden the minds of the Ashkenazi Jewish public that Jewish food is much broader and diverse than just Ashkenazic food. And I think that that's not just me who's doing that. I think that that's been growing. There's a growing awareness of that. But still, people sometimes need to be reminded that not all Jews are Ashkenazim, and therefore that not all Jewish food is Ashkenazic food. But the other side of that coin is I like to defend Ashkenazic food against people like your friend that you mentioned, that, you know, people like to attack Ashkenazic food as low quality or poor tasting or whatever. And I would argue quite the opposite. There's quite a vast array of Ashkenazic food, and many of them taste good too. So I broaden the Jewish food beyond Ashkenazic, but I defend the Ashkenazic food against its detractors. That doesn't really have very much bearing on the second half of the question, but that's also a very important question, which is about Israeli food. And without a doubt, much or at least many dishes that I think are totally Israeli food are not Jewish. And I don't just mean that they're foods that aren't Jewish in origin that the Jews here eat. I mean that there are foods that if you're going to honestly portray Israeli food, then you need to be portraying the foods that Palestinian Arabs and Circassians and Christian Arabs and Armenians and all of them, what they eat, that even Israeli Jews don't know and don't eat. They are part of Israeli culture. And so, yes, 100%. Are those two classifications, Jewish food and Israeli food, is there a significant amount of overlap between them? Of course, because Jews are the majority culture of Israel, where something like 70 to 75% of the citizens of Israel are Jews. So obviously, the majority of the food that we consume in Israel is foods that Jews eat, but that doesn't mean everything. So certainly, Israeli food is not synonymous with Jewish food.
Okay, let's talk about your work specifically. You research, write, and lecture about Jewish food history. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the research that you do and how you go about it.
Sure.
I'm referring to the actual history, not so much the diversity of the food itself.
Right. So I wanted to start because, and this is not something that you brought up, but sometimes people that are maybe introducing me when I speak or something like that, call me a food historian, and I am not a historian, meaning I don't do a lot of primary source research. I rely largely on secondary sources, going to cookbooks, history books, all sorts of sources. It is a very wide range of sources that I look at, but I would never call myself a historian. I'm not trained as a historian. I don't, like I said, I don't look at primary sources. I would say the two main sources that I have are books of many, many, many types, as well as talking to people. So when you talk to people, obviously, there's a pro and a con to it. The pro is that you're getting real concrete testimony as to what people eat and or cook. The drawback to it is that I can only talk to people who are alive right now. So I can only find out what people are doing now. And what somebody does today is not necessarily what was done even 40 years ago, let alone 300 years ago or more. And often people have a tendency, because food is an everyday habit, if you will, we have a tendency to sort of create myths or legends about our food and believe things about our food that may not actually be true. So I can trust what somebody says about what they did and maybe about what their mother did or grandmother did, But that doesn't mean that their great, 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 great grandmother made it the same way. And that's, you know, a pro and a con. There's benefits in both. I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. There's a food called kube, also sometimes pronounced kibe. It is common in the region between Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Kurdistan, that area. It is basically kind of a dumpling with a dough on the outside and ground meat on the inside. There's many, many, many versions of this, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 different types of kube. But one of the common ones, or one of the common categories that actually becomes many types because it goes into a soup and there's different soups, is in Israel, typically most people make it using semolina flour on the outside. And if I went to, let's say, a Kurd today, a Kurdish Jew today, and I say, talk to them about their kuba soup, they'll say, yeah, yeah, this is the way my grandma made it. And they're not wrong. Their grandma did make it that way with semolina, but only in Israel. Because in Iraq or in Kurdistan, that same exact kuba was traditionally made using rice flour. But when they moved to Israel during the 1950s, when there was what we call the Tzena, an austerity period with a lot of shortages of food and there was no rice, they started making it with semolina instead of the rice flour. And that became the traditional way of making it here. So if I ask them, how do you make this dish? They will tell me to make it with semolina, and it's delicious with semolina. But that's not the way their great grandmother made it in Iraq.
So when you're talking about Jewish food history, are you talking about the evolution of dishes such as what you just described?
When I can. Obviously, finding roots of foods is near impossible, but we can make sometimes educated guesses. And I think that it is interesting because it highlights, for example, various things. Like that one highlights the element of the fact that the piece of our history of when people came here, that they had a shortage. So that's an important part of a history that's sent up. And that food change highlights that. Other things might highlight how we got from one place to another when we moved. There's all sorts of things that can be highlighted by looking at changes in food. And that's one of the things I look at. I don't have one specific thing I look at because I have a lot of interests. And so like when I lecture, my topics are on a broad array of things connected with food history.
For example,
I have a talk that is fairly historical in nature, which is about Jews as transporters of food around the world. I think that perhaps disproportionate to our numbers, we have been involved in bringing foods from one area to another area in the world. And understanding why that is highlights certain things about our culture. On the other hand, I would have a talk that is about symbolic foods for Rosh Hashanah, that as you may know, that there are many, many, many different foods with symbolic meanings that are traditionally eaten for Rosh Hashanah. That's one that doesn't deal as much with history. That deals a lot with the development of Jewish customs and laws and how these things developed along the way, and also more about the philosophy of Judaism, our religious philosophy. Why is it that we are looking for meaning in all of these foods and things of that nature? So different talks focus on different elements of Jewish food history. People say that food expresses culture. And if so, then I think that you should be able to look at the food and use it as a mirror to see the culture reflected back. So any element of Jewish culture, I believe, should be reflected somewhere in our foods.
So do you also talk about how the Jewish populations in the different countries adapted the local foods to the Jewish dietary laws?
Often, whenever it's relevant, but absolutely. That's obviously a very interesting story when it happens. And in fact, it happens in nearly every country, I would say. Almost everywhere you can find a food that non-Jews ate and that was not kosher inherently, that there's a Jewish version of it. Sometimes it would mean that the dish mixed milk and meat, and so you need to find a way of replacing one of those two elements. Sometimes it was made with a non-kosher animal like pork, and you replace it with something else. You know, there's numerous things that come up as ways of making something not kosher, but it does happen a lot, and it's definitely a big story, a big aspect of the story of Jewish food history.
You have a blog which is called Taste of Jewish Culture, which we will include a link to. Tell us about the blog. When did you start it and why? And what kind of things does it contain?
Sure. So I was already beginning researching Jewish food history and started doing some lectures on it. I don't know exactly, let's say probably 5, 6, 7 years ago at least. But when Corona hit, and I was no longer having the opportunity to work as a tour guide for quite some time, that actually gave me the opportunity to ramp it up more, all of the food history stuff, because I had a lot more time on my hands. So I took it to the next level. It's when I started to write articles on the subject. It's when I started the blog. I don't remember exactly, but it was very early, probably right before Pesach of 2020 is when I began that blog. And I started to do lectures online. And later on, I started to do more lecture tours and things of that nature. So that really gave me the opportunity to take that side of what I was doing and ramp it up a lot more. It's also the time that I started to work on the book that I am nearing completion of the first draft. So all of those things happened because I had more time. And then once tourism returned, I just was able to continue both of them.
I would like to talk a little bit about the book, this new book that you're working on about Shabbat stews from around the world. I know it hasn't been published yet, as you just said, and maybe when it is published, we could do a whole program about it, because I think it probably deserves a whole program. So could you tell us when it will be published and maybe give us a little tease about it?
Sure. So I can't tell you when it will be published. I do not yet have a publisher. I'm still in the process of working on that. I am nearing completion on the first draft. That's a big step, but it will need massive editing and revision and all of that. So it's still some time away. I will say what the book is about and the idea of it. So the book tentatively is called Cholent, the Most Jewish Food on Earth. And of course, it is not only about Cholent, which is specifically an Ashkenazic Shabbat stew. It is about all Shabbat stews from around the world. Cholent, Chamin, Adafina, Schina, tens of others, Tibit, Osavo, etc. Virtually every Jewish community in the world has some multi-ingredient, typically meaty stew that is begun cooking on Friday and left to slow cook overnight for the entire evening until Saturday to be eaten as a hot lunch for Shabbat. The original reason for this is a sort of a loophole in Jewish law that although you're not allowed to actively cook on the Sabbath, you can leave something passively, something that is already fully cooked. You can leave it passively warming for all of the Sabbath. And that allows us to have a hot dish to honor the Sabbath on Saturday as opposed to Friday night. What I argue in the book, and I'm not the first to point this out, but what I argue in the book is that rather than being different dishes, these are all different versions of the same dish. And that as we moved throughout the diaspora, we brought that dish with us and it morphed at each place based on what ingredients were available locally, what the local tastes were, what our economic status was, etc. And so the book uses this dish as a way of tracing the routes of our migrations through the diaspora and exploring our status in each place as we go along.
I'm really looking forward to it when it comes out. You'll have to let us know.
Thank you. And I will say also that if anybody goes to either of my websites, one of them is tasteofjew.com. The other is cholentbook.com. That one is directly connected with the book. You can sign up for my newsletter. And if you do, you can download a free e-cookbook that I created as a promotion for this. It's 12 Shabbat stew recipes from around the world. It's free. It's a great way to learn a little bit more about the topic.
Yeah, we'll definitely include a link to that also. Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
The only thing I'll say is that I am heading to the States in October, November for a lecture tour. So if you follow my websites or whatever, you'll be able to see a schedule there. And hopefully I'll get to see people there. I know that your main audience is in Spain, of course.
No, wait. Not necessarily. Our main audience for this program is in the English speaking world. So, I mean, we have, I don't know how many people listen to this in Spain because it's in English.
Okay. Well, if any of you are in America, I intend to be there October, November. I'm already booking. It's not fully booked, but I'm booking lots of things. And I also hope to return. This will be my third trip there now for lectures and hope to get back at least one or two more times in the next year after that as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Linda. Thank you for having me.
And if you would like a taste of Joel's new book, his e-cookbook, which contains 12 different Shabbat stew recipes from around the world, is downloadable for free on his websites, the links to which are on this page.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.